As we end one year and begin another, a look back at the top Kansas news stories of 2017. I'm Kay McIntyre, and today on KPR Presents, we'll revisit some of the highlights and low points of the year gone by with a little help from KPR's news department. We'll start today's program with KPR sports correspondent Greg Ecklin and the tragic accident that took the life of Kansas City Royals pitcher Yordano Ventura in January 2017.
It was on a Sunday morning when the news broke, and totally, obviously, unexpected because it was a traffic accident in the Dominican Republic that happened overnight. So the news filtered out of the Dominican on that morning, and then a widespread reaction, not just within the Latino countries, but in the United States and in Kansas City, because this was an individual who was signed to a contract extension with the Kansas City Royals and was expected to do yet some great things for the Kansas City Royals and was looked upon as a pitcher who was just beginning to tap his potential.
What did we ever learn about the accident itself?
Not much, because the reports will not ever be publicized. The police reports, because of the family's wish, will not be released to the public. So other than the traffic accident itself, which was a one-car accident or a one-vehicle accident, no one will ever know what the toxicology report will be. But from the Royals' standpoint, and there may be some knowledge, I don't know, but there may be some knowledge within the organization. But from that point, it was not just honoring him because of what he had already given the organization, but in another mode, the Royals had to scramble very quickly for someone or someone of that type to replace him very quickly as they looked forward to the 2017 season.
And the Royals continued to mourn his loss throughout the 2017 season. They, if I'm remembering right, they wore a patch on their uniforms.
Yes.
And his mother came and threw out
the first pitch on opening day. It was a very moving moment, and though the Royals did sign a couple of frontline pitchers, Nate Karns and Jason Hamill, to help offset the loss on the mound, I think emotionally, I'm not sure if the team really ever got over the sudden passing of Yordano Ventura.
KPR sports correspondent Greg Ecklin on one of the top news stories of 2017, the tragic death of Kansas City Royal Yordano Ventura. I'm Kay McIntyre. Today on KPR Presents, we're revisiting some of the highlights and low points of the year gone by, with some help from KPR's news department. On January 20th, 2017, thousands of people gathered in Washington, D.C. for the inauguration of President Donald Trump. On January 21st, more than 3 million Americans, mostly women, gathered in D.C., Topeka, Kansas City, Wichita, and all across the country in what would be known as the Women's March. Laura Lorson is the host of All Things Considered on Kansas Public Radio.
It ended up being a lot of different things that people were worked up about. So there wasn't any one particular sign, you know, that people were, it wasn't, we demand feminism or we demand you prosecute sexual predators. There's just a large number of things that people had been feeling uneasy about. And after the president's election, which I think was a surprise to many people, a significant number of women felt that they had to do something. And in the history of civil disobedience, this seemed like the right answer. I was very impressed at the number of people who turned out in Topeka, very impressed by the number of people who turned up in those mid-sized cities like Omaha, like Louisville. This wasn't just a whoever can manage to get to Washington, D.C. is engaged and involved. This was nationwide. And I think that is why this is going to end up being a watershed moment in activism in the U.S., because that particular movement, the Women's March movement, certainly has continued, not necessarily in marches, but it provided a database. The use of social media was very important, and it connected a lot of women city to city to city in order to mobilize on other issues, because that is still ongoing. If you go to womensmarch.org, you will still see you'll have the opportunity to sign up for different actions. There's gun control, there's equality, there's sexual harassment, all these issues that are of concern to not just women, but particularly women. I think that is really the significant thing. It created this activist group that hadn't been activists before, because I think there was a sense that activism was something you did in the 60s, that we were sort of past that now. Now you sign a petition, you vote with your pocketbook.
You go online.
Yeah. But this was an actual physical act that when enough people commit a physical act, it really can't be ignored. So I think that's what was so surprising and why we are still talking about this Women's March, 12 months later.
Laura, to what extent do you think the Women's March in January maybe set up the conditions for the Me Too movement that we're seeing at the end of 2017?
I think it made people less afraid to say something. I think it gave women who maybe weren't necessarily particularly vocal or particularly forceful, didn't feel like they were great public speakers, kind of just wanted to lead their lives, not interested in getting up in front of a crowd of people, made them realize this is part of citizenship. This is part of democracy. This is what you have to do. Democracy isn't easy. Democracy is very, very difficult and requires action. And we had been in a 20 or 30 year period where we didn't take it a lot. So I don't know that they are necessarily 100% joined at the hip, but I do think the fact that the Women's March came off the way it did with little, if any, disruption. These marches did not turn into riots. There might have been a broken window or whatever. But I think it just convinced a number of women, you have to say something. If you're unhappy, you have to do more than just show up and vote. You have to go one more step. So I think in that way, it was definitely linked. And I also think it made women realize that if you get together to do a thing, people will pay attention. You're not out there on your own. You're not out there alone. So again, I don't know that they're explicitly connected, but it certainly put the idea of I, as a citizen, have a right to be in the public sphere and make my my opinions known. And particularly for younger women, I really think women under 25, this was, I mean, we'll have to see in the history books down the road, but I think this will turn out to have been a watershed moment.
We'll hear more from Laura Lorson later this hour as we continue revisiting the top news stories of 2017. Also in January, big news from Payless Shoe Source when more than 100 people were laid off from their headquarters in Topeka. Payless filed for bankruptcy in April and put their headquarters on the market in December. Jay Schaefer is news director of Kansas Public Radio.
This is a challenge that retailers everywhere are facing, not just the Payless shoe stores that are out there, but Topeka's Westridge Mall, and losing some of the retailers that are in the mall, like Burlington. And there are others, and you know, with more and more people ordering items online, including shoes, that has certainly hurt Payless. I do know that city officials in Topeka have been scrambling to contact officials at Payless to figure out, hey, what can we do to keep as many jobs as possible here in the capital city? But there's a lot we don't know about Payless, just that in this year of 2017, 400 people lost their jobs, and that's a big hit for a city like Topeka.
Another big hit for the city of Topeka this year was St. Francis Hospital.
Yes, for a long, long time, Topeka has been served by two large hospitals, Stormont Vale and St. Francis. The owners of St. Francis, the Sisters of Charity based in Leavenworth, wanted to sell St. Francis, and it you know, through a lot of talk with city and state officials and the owners of the hospital, what came to pass is the University of Kansas Medical Center teamed up with an Ardent private company out of Nashville to take over this hospital. So the KU Health System and the Nashville-based Ardent Health Services will be adding some full-time positions and essentially keeping this hospital around. So it looks like going forward, Topeka will still be served by two large hospitals.
That's KPR News Director Jay Schaefer helping us revisit some of the year's biggest news stories. I'm Kay McIntyre. We return to KPR sports correspondent Greg Eklund for another big story that began in January 2017. This one from Kansas State University and the Wildcat football program.
Of course, Bill Snyder is the oldest coach now on the major college level. And in January, the college football world was shaken by the news that Bill Snyder was going to be undergoing treatments for cancer, for throat cancer. So his whole future, although he came out with a statement pointing to a positive direction, many had wondered if he was going to be able to coach the Wildcats in the 2017 season. When spring football practice took place, capped off by its annual scrimmage in the spring, Coach Snyder was actually coaching from the press box instead of the sideline, which still put into question as to how he is recovering. Is he going to have enough stamina to continue as the coach of the Wildcats through the fall of 2017? Well, his treatments apparently went very well because once the football season started, it was business as usual. And as he looked back on the 2017 regular season, when asked what personal habits he had to change, Bill Snyder said, well, he just had to eat a little bit more.
Hmm.
But the Wildcats, from a football team standpoint, had high expectations in 2017. They were expected to challenge for the Big 12 championship. That did not pan out as planned, but the Wildcats ended up getting a bowl game bid, which ultimately resulted in them traveling to Phoenix and playing in the Cactus Bowl. On the other hand, KU, again, with high expectations, and certainly a team that let a lot of people down with only one victory on the year, is giving Coach David Beatty another chance as they move forward to get that program turned in the right direction. And the Jayhawks are also in the midst of a fundraising program to upgrade the stadium with hopes that a better football team will also go hand in hand with more money raised to renovate the stadium.
It's a $350 million project, which was also to include upgrades to the women's volleyball program, which have now recently just been put on hold.
That's right. The volleyball team currently plays in Horish, and the plan was to completely rebuild Horish because it's a great facility for the Jayhawk volleyball team to be playing in, very intimate atmosphere, a tremendous home court advantage for the Jayhawks. Under the plan, there was expected to be an increased capacity to give more people the opportunity to watch what has turned into a very solid women's volleyball program. But as you mentioned, those plans are on hold.
Greg Eklund is a sports correspondent for Kansas Public Radio. I'm Kay McIntyre. We're revisiting some of the year's top news stories, including a shooting at an Olathe sports bar. Sam Zeff of the Kansas News Service filed this report in February.
First, the suspected shooter, 53-year-old Adam Purington, allegedly began to harass the victims, Srinivas Kuchibotla and Alok Madasani, by questioning their immigration status. After being asked to leave the bar, according to the affidavit, Purington returned with a handgun and began shooting, striking Kuchibotla three times, killing him. Madasani was shot once in the leg. The third victim, Ian Grillot, was shot in the hand and upper chest as he chased the gunman as he made his escape. The whole incident, according to police, was caught on surveillance cameras.
Adam Purinton has since been charged with a federal hate crime in that shooting. One of the big stories of 2016 was widespread wildfires in Kansas and Oklahoma. KPR News Director Jay Schaefer says 2017 proved to be even worse.
2016, we saw record-size fires, and then this year we broke it. Now we've had the worst wildfires in state history in 2017. And, I mean, they were in a number of counties, largely in south-central Kansas and southern Kansas. But, I mean, there were counties everywhere with fires breaking out, including Clark, Ellis, Ellsworth, Hodgman, Lincoln, Reno, Rooks, Russell, just to name a few. I think the worst fire was really in Clark County, which is a rural county with a small population. But I think one thing that city folk lose track of is the toll, the financial toll, and the emotional toll this takes on farmers. So many ranchers lost all of their cattle, all of their livestock, horses as well. Of course, they lost their outbuildings and farmhouses, but miles and miles, thousands of miles of fence line burned up. And of course, these fires really started in north-central Oklahoma and then spread into Kansas. So you had firefighters from Kansas and Oklahoma and even other states coming into Kansas and Oklahoma to fight these wildfires. And again, drought-like conditions are continuing right now as we head into the winter months of 2017 and early 2018. So I think people are going to be on high alert for these high fire-like conditions that we've had for the last couple of years.
That's KPR News Director Jay Schaefer with one of the top Kansas news stories of 2016, 2017, and perhaps 2018 as well. I'm Kay McIntyre. We're recapping some of the biggest news stories of the year on today's KPR Presents. Greg Eklund is bringing us lots of sports news, including a bittersweet NCAA tournament for the University of Kansas men's basketball team.
Early April is the site of the Final Four, and in 2017, it was in Glendale, Arizona. There was big news down in Glendale when Bill Self was named to the Naismith Hall of Fame, the induction ceremony to follow in the month of September. And along with Coach Bill Self's honor, Frank Mason was named Player of the Year, both the AP Player of the Year and the winner of the Oscar Robertson Trophy. So it was a very momentous occasion for the Kansas Jayhawks on the award front. But from a team standpoint, Bill was pretty downtrodden in Phoenix when he learned of those awards, both to Frank Mason and the honor that he himself had received, because all along he thought that the Kansas Jayhawks as a team should have been in Glendale, Arizona, but the Jayhawks fell one game short. It took place in Kansas City at Sprint Center. Jayhawk fans thought this was the opportunity with proximity to Lawrence, that there was a clear home court advantage in a neutral site when Kansas played Oregon in the regional final. But the result didn't turn out favorably for KU, and it was Oregon that went to the Final Four instead of the Kansas Jayhawks.
Jumping ahead to September, when that Hall of Fame induction actually took place, I assume by that point some of the sting of the NCAA tournament had perhaps faded a little bit. What do you remember about Bill Self's induction?
Well, I wasn't there in Springfield, Massachusetts when it took place, but from the reports that I had received from Springfield, he was very humbled by the award. And it's interesting that he's still an active coach while receiving the award, but he's not the first coach to do that. There have been others like Roy Williams and Rick Pitino, who are also, at least in the case of Roy Williams, Rick Pitino's circumstances changed pretty quickly. But at the time they were inducted into the Hall of Fame as well, they were active coaches. So it puts them somewhat in a uncomfortable situation, because this is an award that honors players and coaches who you would think be looking back on a career. But in the instance of Bill Self in 2017, it's still while he's very much active as a coach of the KU Jayhawks.
That's KPR sports correspondent Greg Ecklin. I'm Kay McIntyre. On today's KPR Presents, we're recapping some of the year's top news stories. On April 6, 2017, thousands of people gathered in Kansas City to commemorate the 100th anniversary of America's entry into World War I. It started with a flyover by the Patrouille de France, eight jets from the French Air Force trailing streams of red, white, and blue. More than 3,000 people gathered on the grounds of the National World War I Museum and Memorial, which featured music from the 1st Infantry Division Band, cannon fire, and a dramatic narration of the events leading up to America's declaration of war.
Sea traffic will be stopped with every available weapon and without further notice.
Neutrality is no longer feasible or desirable, where the peace of the world is involved and the freedom of its principles.
To whom does the war bring prosperity? Not to the soldier, not to the broken-hearted widow.
The approved declaration of war was sent to President Wilson on April 6, 1917. At 1 p.m. that day, he signed, approved, 6 April 1917, Woodrow Wilson.
You can hear highlights from the National World War I Centennial Commemoration archived on KPR's website. I'm Kay McIntyre. We're revisiting some of the big news stories of 2017 on today's KPR Presents. In May, Army Private Chelsea Manning was released from Fort Leavenworth 7 years after being taken into custody for what may have been the largest leak of classified data in U.S. history. This from KPR's Laura Lorson.
Upwards of 200,000 cables from the U.S. embassies in various Middle Eastern countries were released to the public. Many of these had to do with the individuals who were being imprisoned at Guantanamo Bay in Cuba. Specifically, those cables regarding Guantanamo prisoners were released by the New York Times and the Guardian. And the important thing to know about those particular cables, the reason they were secret, is they contained very specific descriptions of how these prisoners were being treated at Guantanamo Bay. There were psychological profiles in there. There was information about what exactly was being done physically to these prisoners. And this was not something that the U.S. government necessarily wanted in the public sphere. Chelsea Manning was at the time had access to these cables and by all accounts really wrestled with, I believe that the public has a right to know, but I have taken an oath in working here with the NSA to not let anybody see these. Ultimately, he decided it was in everybody's best interest. If he had to go to jail, so be it. That's really the fundamental difference between Chelsea Manning and Edward Snowden, because Edward Snowden was working with sensitive documents and had them released and promptly left the country, whereas Chelsea Manning said, I'm going to release these and I'm all in. If I have to go to prison, then that's what I have to do. So that's really the fundamental difference between Snowden and Manning. They were releasing similar documents with similar secrets. One left the country, one stayed. Chelsea Manning ended up in prison, pleaded guilty to leaking information, but pleaded not guilty to the most serious charge, which was aiding and abetting the enemy. Was court-martialed, was sentenced to 35 years. The day after she was sentenced to 35 years in prison, she announced that she was transgender and she wanted to seek gender reassignment surgery and she wished to be known as Chelsea. Fast forward to 2017, President Obama, in the last days of his presidency, decided to commute Chelsea Manning's sentence. A lot of people thought that meant Chelsea Manning was pardoned, which is not the case. In short, you have served 4 years of this 35-year sentence. You've been in prison. We are now letting you out of prison.
Chelsea Manning walked out of Leavenworth in May. Do we know what she's been up to since then?
Activism in a lot of ways. She's been writing. She hasn't done a lot of TV, but she is certainly in the public sphere doing a lot of social media. She's had several things to talk about, but I think she's having to prioritize. And right now the transgender issue is very important because, you know, she's the beneficiary of various services from the U.S. government. And obviously the issue of how transgender people are treated globally, locally, and then specifically in the military, that's something she can speak to. So she's using her voice mostly for that right now. But I wouldn't be surprised to see her come more strongly back into the discussion when and if Edward Snowden ever comes back to the United States. I think there will be a lot for her to talk about at that time.
That's KPR's Laura Lorson. I'm Kay McIntyre. If you're just joining us, today on KPR Presents, we're recapping some of the year's top Kansas news stories. Once again, KPR sports correspondent Greg Eklund with this June 2017 news from the Kansas City Chiefs.
John Dorsey was unexpectedly released as it was a mutual decision, actually, because the Chiefs at that time announced that they extended the contract of coach Andy Reid. But at the same time, the Chiefs announced that they were not extending the contract of their general manager. So it was a mutual parting of the ways between John Dorsey and the Chiefs. It was an unexpected move because a draft had already taken place earlier in April. John Dorsey very much had his fingerprints on the draft, and the big news from the draft just a couple of months earlier was the fact that the Chiefs made a trade to move up and draft a quarterback, Patrick Mahomes, who is regarded as the quarterback of the future for the Chiefs. What preceded the John Dorsey parting was also another unexpected move. When Jeremy Maclin, who was an Andy Reid favorite, who Andy Reid had known from his playing days in Philadelphia, when Andy Reid was coaching in Philadelphia, was also unexpectedly released after the Chiefs had conducted one of their mini camps. Part of it was because of salary cap reasons, because NFL teams must get themselves under the salary cap. And I think none of the reasons for the firing has specifically come out, but most people think that it was because of John Dorsey's mismanagement of the salary cap and because of the position and the difficult position that the Chiefs find themselves in as they look into future years in locking up players that they'd like to lock up under the restrictions of the salary cap.
That's KPR sports correspondent Greg Eklund. I'm Kay McIntyre. One of the big stories of 2016 was the announcement by University of Kansas Chancellor Bernadette Gray Little that she would step down in 2017. As KPR News Director Jay Schaefer tells us, that came to pass last summer, and KU now has a new chancellor.
Gray Little, of course, was the first African-American woman to lead the University of Kansas, and in fact, the first woman to lead the school in its storied history. So we knew she was leaving. We didn't know who the successor was going to be, but then, of course, we found out. And the successor is actually coming from the University of Kansas. Doug Girard became the 18th chancellor of KU in July of this year. And before becoming chancellor, Dr. Girard served in a variety of capacities. Number one, he's a surgeon, but he served as the vice chancellor, executive vice chancellor at the KU Med Center, and oversaw educational research, patient care, and many other activities at the facility in Kansas City. He first joined the KU Medical Center faculty in 1994. So he's been around for a while. He knows the players. He knows the Med Center very well, of course, and University of Kansas Hospital. Now he's becoming more and more familiar with the Lawrence campus and the other KU campuses that are spread out across the state. Remember, we've got a KU facility in Salina. There's a KU campus in Wichita. There's the Edwards campus in Johnson County. So he's got a big mission, a big job before him. A lot of what the chancellor does these days at universities is raise money. And Bernadette Gray Little raised a lot of money for the University of Kansas. Yes, she had a lot of help from others, but she will be remembered for the vast amount of research dollars she attracted, scholarship money and whatnot. We'll see if Dr. Douglas Girard can do the same, but he's already a known entity, and he's a Jayhawk, so I think that's probably going to work out for a lot of people who are fans of KU. He has yet to visit us here at the radio station, but, you know, there's a lot of departments and a lot of schools here at the University of Kansas, but we hope to welcome him to our studios soon.
Chancellor Girard, consider that your invitation.
Absolutely. And I probably, you know, maybe I shouldn't say anything like that because he is really my boss's boss's boss. So, but we'd love to have you here.
That's KPR News Director Jay Schaefer. I'm Kay McIntyre. Let's stick with Jay Schaefer for one of the most exciting news stories of 2017, the solar eclipse of August 21st.
It's something that I personally had been looking forward to for months, ever since I first heard about it, and had been reading about it. And one of the first things I did as a news person was find out where in Kansas is going to be the best place to see this celestial event that hadn't taken place for, you know, nearly 100 years. The last time there was a coast-to-coast, all-American, total solar eclipse that could be seen from Kansas was like back in 1917 or something close to that, nearly 100 years. So I was really looking forward to it. I'd never seen a total solar eclipse, and many other people hadn't either. So I found out perhaps the best place to see it was Troy, Kansas, which is in Doniphan County, extreme northeast corner of Kansas. And I got a hold of the economic development director for Doniphan County, Aiden Corson, interviewed her. She was very excited. She said, you know, for this small town of Troy, this is like hitting the lottery. We're in the direct path of this solar eclipse, and we're going to experience totality for a minute and 38 seconds. The most that anyone would be able to experience totality is a minute 40. So we're only 2 seconds off the maximum time. So she was very excited. I took that day off work. I talked my sister into taking off that day off work. My wife, my sister, my niece, her boyfriend, we all went to Troy, Kansas. And it was spectacular. It was cloudy. It was overcast. It was off and on raining. But just before the moment of totality for Troy, Kansas, the clouds parted, and there it was, the total solar eclipse. And we were just in awe. I mean, the people that talk about this that have seen it before and had talked to me said, the difference between 99% totality and 100% totality is like the difference between night and day. One of them is a life-changing event, and the other one's just kind of cool. I'm glad I got to see the life-changing event. I don't know that it changed my life, but it was pretty spectacular.
I'm a little jealous because I, like you, took off the day. My husband and I went up to Horton, Kansas, and the excitement was just unbelievable. There were hundreds of people that had come from all over the country. I met some people from my hometown of Cedar Rapids, Iowa, that drove down just to see the eclipse. Now, I have to say, it was spectacular, but where we were, it was cloudy. So you didn't really get the full effect. Having said that, it was pretty dark. I think the most amazing thing for me was the sense that it's really dark overhead, but that you got that the light on the horizon.
360-degree sunset.
Yes.
Everywhere you looked as you made a circle, if you walked around in a circle, you could see a sunset, and usually we can only see that in the western sky. But at that moment of totality, it's like 10 o'clock at night, but if you look on the horizon, north, south, east, west, it's a sunset. Utterly unbelievable. It was worth every penny I paid, and I didn't pay a lot, to get to Troy, Kansas. And I think we were very lucky. People in nearby St. Joe, thousands, tens of thousands of people went to St. Joseph, Missouri, and didn't see anything. Too much cloud cover, too much rain. We got lucky in Troy, and I think some other folks got lucky that were also up in northeast Kansas and pretty much right in the heart of the band of that path of totality.
For me, it was easily one of the highlights of the whole year.
Best thing about 2017, by far. for me.
That's KPR News Director Jay Schaefer geeking out on the August 21st solar eclipse. In September, Tyson Chicken caught the town of Tonganoxie by surprise when they announced plans to build a $320 million processing plant. We've got more from KPR's Laura Lorson.
The demand for chicken is huge. Huge, and to the extent that you can't keep up with it. So Tyson decided we want to build a plant. $320 million is what we intend to spend on it. Details of the negotiations, we still don't truly know. It really did feel like one day, here's sleepy Tonganoxie, and the next day, here's Governor Sam Brownback and a Tyson guy saying, hi, we're building a giant chicken processing facility, which is like the cleanest, tidiest possible way to say we're going to kill and pluck a colossal number of chickens in a very, very large set of buildings that we are going to put here in Leavenworth County. That's what we are going to do. The announcement was heralded because it was yet another large employer, and it's a large employer that intends to give 1,600 people or so jobs that pay anywhere between $12 and $20 an hour. That ain't hay, as they say. Those are good jobs. You can raise family on that job. Great. 1,600 people are going to get employed. A lot of tax dollars are going to flow to the state, specifically to Leavenworth County, specifically to City of Tonganoxie. It is a feather in the cap of the Brownback administration and a very visible endorsement of the policy that involved pass-through income for large corporations and thus provide testimony that the corporate tax breaks that had been built into the system were working. They were bringing jobs to this area because it wasn't just the expansion of a plant that was already there. This was a whole new facility from the ground up. However, it turns out that whereas maybe 5 years ago this would have been met with universal acclaim, a significant number of people, not just one angry, you know, lady. You can always count on one or two people who are not happy about a new development coming in, particularly when it involves livestock. Livestock operations smell bad. They use a ton of water. They're very disruptive in a lot of ways. It's difficult work. It is physical work. Again, there's a reason these jobs pay well. It's because it's incredibly difficult work. So you can expect a certain proportion of people to always be unhappy that that's the industry that's coming into the area. A significant number of people started asking very pointed questions about why Tonganoxie? Why now? How did this happen? Why didn't we hear about it till now? Don't we have to have hearings about this? Isn't that part of you know, the development process, the economic development process? And so a lot of questions were raised, and there were some very heated meetings.
There were thousands of people that turned out, I think it was on a Friday evening, to say, no Tyson in Tongi.
Yeah. And what I think is really important here, they addressed issues that the state of Kansas could not just ignore and say, we will fix that another day. They sat down and sketched out this group of people opposed to Tyson and Tongi, saying, here's how much it's going to cost to improve our roads to accommodate 1,600 new jobs. And let's just assume it's not just 1,600 people. These are people who have families. So let's quadruple that just for the sake of argument. So how are our roads going to handle an additional 6,500 people? How's our water system going to be able to serve these people? Do we have enough housing stock in this area if people want to live in this area? We don't have room in the schools for their children. We don't have the facilities to make this happen. And this group of people went through and said, look, here's how much money it's going to cost us to fix all of these problems this is about to create. Now, we understand that there may or may not be tax money coming in because, you know, this is all going to be paid for with STAR bonds. There were big tax breaks being given as well. They made it worth Tyson's while. But the people of Tonganoxie who were opposed to this made it clear, we cannot wait for 10 years down the road for this money to come in for us to address these problems. They have to be addressed right now. And I think it was by formulating very specific concerns, particularly about infrastructure. That's what I think really turned the tide for them. We don't have the infrastructure. We don't have the money. We can't do it. Thanks, but no thanks.
KPR's Laura Lorson on Tyson's announcement that they would build a chicken processing plant in Tonganoxie and their subsequent decision to cancel those plans. We're up to October 2017 when three people were killed and two others wounded in a downtown Lawrence shooting spree. KPR's Stephen Caranda has this report.
Ahmad Rayton is charged with attempted second-degree murder and being a felon in possession of a weapon. Dominique McMillan is charged with aggravated assault and battery. None of the charges stem from the three deaths. Lawrence Police Captain Adam Heffley would not say if they are looking for additional shooters, but says they anticipate more arrests.
This investigation is ongoing, and we are still looking for subjects, witnesses, anyone who has information about this. We are still working this case as we were the last 2 weeks with the same intensity until we bring everybody in.
Heffley says they have followed around 200 leads during the investigation. For the Kansas News Service, I'm Stephen Caranda in Lawrence.
A third man, 20-year-old Anthony LaRon Roberts Jr. of Topeka, was later charged with one count of first-degree murder and two counts of second-degree murder in the shooting. We're up to November 2017 when Kansas City voters gave the green light to building a new Kansas City airport. We have this from Lisa Rodriguez of the Kansas News Service.
Recent polls indicated the race would be close, but in the end, 75% of voters approved a new terminal. As results came in, Kansas City Mayor Sly James congratulated his colleagues, pointing out that just over a year ago, he put conversations about a new airport on hold due to lack of public support.
We've come a long, long way. But here we are tonight, and the voters of Kansas City have sent us a very clear message. Again, that they're excited about the direction the city is headed in, and they want us to keep that momentum going.
Voter turnout in Jackson, Platte, and Clay counties was around 20%. That's double the turnout of the last special election in Kansas City. I'm Lisa Rodriguez.
I'm Kay McIntyre. Today on KPR Presents, we're revisiting some of the top news stories of 2017 with help from KPR's news department and a few ringers. KCI, the solar eclipse, wildfires, we've covered a lot of 2017 with one notable exception, politics. For the rest of this hour, KPR State House Bureau Chief Stephen Caranda and I revisit some of the year's biggest political news. We'll start back in January 2017 with Lynn Jenkins' surprise announcement that she would not seek another term in Congress.
Well, it was a pretty big surprise because Jenkins was in the leadership of the House. And so when John Boehner was leaving, you know, that kind of made it make a little more sense. But it raised then a lot of questions about what she would do next. And we all expected her to run for governor, someone with a lot of name recognition, a lot of, you know, conservative Republican bona fides. We all thought she would have been quite a competitive candidate for governor. Then she said she's not going to run for any office next year. So that was a surprise also. It looks like she's going to go off, try some new things. But, you know, a lot of people guess that this probably isn't the last we've heard of Lynn Jenkins. She could be on the ticket around here for some job in the future.
How is that playing out in the 2nd District leading forward?
So this is a district that Governor Brownback did not win in the last race for governor. So I think Democrats really feel like they have a shot. And Paul Davis, the Democratic basically leading candidate at this point, is the person who won the district in the race for governor. So they feel like they have a chance. A lot of it really depends on kind of the national mood. You know, it's a district where a Democrat can do well if you look at, you know, the demographics and the voter registration trends. But I think a lot of it is going to have to do with outside forces. If Republicans have kind of turned it around nationally and the president is popular and they're, you know, popular in the district, then the Democrats have a really tough race in the 2nd District. If as we've seen in some of the last elections, Democrats are doing better than they traditionally do because of some of these national forces, then Democrats might have a real shot. And it also depends who the Republicans end up nominating in the second district. Some of the candidates so far who have been running are maybe controversial, so I think it also depends who the Republicans ultimately end up with in that race.
Also in January, Congressman Mike Pompeo was confirmed as President Trump's director of the CIA, the Central Intelligence Agency. Talk about Pompeo's ascent to the national stage and how that's played out in the 4th District.
Well, the 4th District turned out to really be what we've seen in a lot of other races. Democrats performed better than they traditionally would in that area, but in the 4th District, they didn't get a win. So, obviously, Pompeo has had quite a rise. He hadn't been in Congress that long, and now there's a lot of talk that he might be taking over as Secretary of State or something. So, he's really a Kansas official who clearly has a lot of influence now in the president's administration and appears to be one of the people who will continue to have a lot of influence with President Trump.
And he was succeeded in that 4th district by Ron Estes.
Correct. Ron Estes won the seat, the Republican candidate. James Thompson, the Democrat, did better than traditionally Democrats would do in that district, but did not win. So that's one of these races where we'll be looking at down the road. It would be a big push for a Democrat to win that seat, but it's one that we're watching to see what happens in 2018.
And just a reminder, that district, which includes the Wichita area, used to be held by Democratic congressman, if you go back to Dan Glickman's day.
And we also had, you know, the second district used to have a Democratic congresswoman here in Kansas. So we've really seen kind of Kansas becoming redder in recent years. It's unclear now if in 2018 we're going to see kind of a move back and Democrats doing better in these places. To me, again, that's not clear and will maybe depend some on national forces.
Staying on the national stage, the year started with a lot of speculation about the role that Kansas Governor Sam Brownback would play in President Trump's administration. As the year ends, that's still up in the air.
It really is. You know, when President Trump was elected, we started hearing rumors that the governor would be up for some job. I mean, the executive director of the Republican Party at the time, Clay Barker, said people in Trump's administration had told him there were jobs for the governor if he wanted them. So it really came down to, did Governor Brownback want to stay in Kansas or go to the Trump administration? So now we're really waiting to see what happens. He's obviously been nominated for this job as the at-large ambassador for international religious freedom, if I have the title right. I think that's right. So now the question is, will he be confirmed by the time the legislative session starts in January? He's already said that he's handed over the reins on some big issues to Lieutenant Governor Jeff Collier. He said Collier's doing the budget. Collier recently picked a new cabinet secretary. Collier has been doing all the preparations for the session, it looks like. So we're kind of in this period where Brownback is obviously still the governor, but he's handing over some of the powers to the lieutenant governor, and it's just not clear on big issues who's going to be taking charge in the coming weeks.
Has that led to some awkwardness around the State House in terms of what Jeff Collier's role should be right now?
It has, because I think even for lawmakers, when they have questions about issues or they want to make a point about something, they're not 100% sure who to talk to. I think now they're directing a lot of that to the lieutenant governor. But Collier can't be stepping on Brownback's toes. I mean, he's really been careful to say, you know, there's one governor at a time. But at the same time, now he's picking cabinet secretaries. And like I said, Brownback has said he's creating the budget.
Brownback's pending departure has created an opportunity for lots of people that have their eye on the governorship. In fact, it's a really crowded field for the Kansas governor. How many candidates at this point have tossed their hats in the ring?
I can't even remember. The last time I counted, we were over a dozen when you consider both parties. Governor Brownback was term limited, so he wouldn't have been running again either way. But kind of all this shakeup really is, I think, adding fuel to this fire where more people are jumping into the race. this is a year where, you know, we have big names like Secretary Chris Kobach, but we have the Lieutenant Governor Jeff Collier positioning himself to be kind of the conservative mainstream Republican candidate. I'm the longtime executive director of the Kansas GOP, Clay Barker, who's really well respected, stepped down to work in Collier's administration and it's a safe to assume in his election campaign. So we really have that, plus then other credible candidates in the mix, such as former House member Mark Hutton, former state senator Jim Barnett, who also was a candidate for governor in the past. We have a lot of people who are credible candidates, but we just don't know how this race is going to break down, how many of them are going to still be in the race when it comes time to actually vote. And then you add in, we recently have seen motions that make it look like Greg Orman, the independent candidate, will be running. And that just further throws everything up in the air. So this is, you know, this early for a governor's race in Kansas, we've had so many people jumping in. And I think it just makes it, you know, a huge race to watch next year as it continues to develop.
One of the more surprising things about this year's governorship race is the number of really young people who have thrown their hats in the ring. We have a number of high school students who say they'd like to be governor.
We have. They on both sides of the ticket. I think it appears the parties believe they are not credible candidates. There's been some talk of putting restrictions in place so they can't be at the debates between the candidates. But it's a very interesting development. It's interesting to hear these new voices, and it just shows how much variety there is in this big pool of candidates for the state's top job.
Let's talk about one of those candidates in particular. Chris Kobach, there was a lot of rumor about the role that he would play within the Trump administration. What has his role been this year?
Well, we all remember the big hubbub when he was having a meeting with President Trump and had a sheet of paper under his arm. And if you zoomed in on the photo, you could see much of what was written on the paper. And it made it clear that he was in the running for a high job in DHS, the Department of Homeland Security, which makes a lot of sense with Secretary Kobach, with some of the things he's been interested in, immigration and things like that. He then either wasn't selected for the top job or wasn't offered a job he wanted exactly, so he decided to run for Kansas governor, another thing we were expecting he could do. But he kind of found a way to do both, because he's now running for governor. He's one of the biggest candidates in that race. But he's still working with President Trump by leading or being vice chair, but effectively the leader of this President Trump's Voter Fraud Commission and Voter Integrity Commission. So he's kind of found a way to continue working with President Trump while running for governor here in Kansas. And his connections to the president are already starting to come into play in the governor's race. We had a fundraiser with one of President Trump's sons here in Kansas for Secretary Kobach.
2017 was another busy and controversial year inside the State House in Topeka. We started the year with some very real budget issues and a sense that maybe the Kansas experiment wasn't working.
And you mean specifically the Kansas tax experiment. And we say that because Governor Brownback has called it that in the past. You know, we came into it knowing that we had a legislature that was less conservative than we've seen in recent years. And many of them were more interested in changing the tone on taxes. So they worked through bills, they passed bills, which then got a veto from the governor. And ultimately, they ended up overriding the governor on this. And this was, you know, these really were, you know, Governor Brownback's tax cuts. And it's, at first you might think that's not the case because these are very different than what he initially proposed when he became governor. But since they were passed, they were clear that they were his tax cuts because he continued to defend them consistently to the point where he vetoed a bill to change them this year and ultimately was overridden by Republicans in the legislature. So it was just, you know, such a huge culmination for this to happen and just such a big event that it almost, well, it surely does outshine to me everything else that happened in the legislative session and was probably the biggest, you know, legislative political event of the year to me.
If that's the case, probably the second biggest political issue of the year has to be school finance. Stephen, bring us up to date on the continuing battle between the legislature and the Kansas courts on how much we should be funding our schools.
So we had the reversal of the tax cuts mostly this year that helped stabilize our budget. They also added more money for education. So when I was looking at this, you know, I was seeing monthly tax collections coming in above estimates, even when you accounted for the increase in taxes. And so I was looking at all this thinking, boy, the next couple years look like they're going to be pretty easy on the budget front. Then we had the Supreme Court come down saying, oh, what you've done on school funding is not enough. And now it looks like the 2018 legislative session is going to be a really tough one again, because we're down to the point where unless tax collections are just through the roof higher than we expect, there's not going to be enough money to add hundreds and hundreds of millions of dollars more for K-12 education without cutting other state services or increasing taxes. And those are going to be the big options. Do you want to cut other things in state government to funnel more money to K-12 education? Do you want to raise taxes to give more money to K-12 schools? Or do you want to butt heads with the court and try to do something less than they expect or change the Constitution or something like that? So, boy, this next session looks really tough. And Lieutenant Governor Collier, when he becomes Governor Collier, I see as just stepping into the job at a time there's going to be some really tough decisions that have to be made.
So just to be clear, the Kansas courts had previously decided that school funding in Kansas was inequitable. And this past year in 2017, they said, not only is it inequitable, it's not sufficient. There needs to be more money going in.
Yeah, there's just been, the reason I'm sure people are confused by this is because there have been many rulings in this in multiple lawsuits over the years. So where we are now is school funding was ruled inequitable, as you said, lawmakers made some changes, then it was also ruled inadequate, and they made some changes, and the court said that wasn't enough.
Another issue that involves children is, of course, the state's foster care system. The Kansas Department for Children and Families, DCF, came under a lot of scrutiny this year with a growing list of concerns about the foster care system. What's happened with that?
The biggest thing is that Phyllis Gilmore, the secretary, has left the job. We were all wondering if this controversy would mean Lieutenant Governor Jeff Collier would replace her when he took over. I asked him that question once in an interview if he had confidence in her, and he wouldn't say either way. Now he has selected a replacement for her after she announced she was retiring. So it's clear, you know, a lot of people, there had been calls from some lawmakers for her to be replaced. So it didn't come as a huge surprise, but that still is a big step for its cabinet secretary to be replaced. And it really was pushed by these revelations that, you know, kids have to sleep in offices sometimes because there aren't enough placements, and that kids have been lost from the foster care system, seemingly without the, you know, higher ups at the administration knowing on a day-to-day basis about some of those issues.
Another Kansas cabinet secretary who lost their job this year was Antonio Suave, the secretary of the Department of Commerce.
This was a very interesting story because Suave left and he was running for the 2nd District congressional seat.
Lynn Jenkins' seat.
Correct. And so he's a Republican because he was serving with Brownback. And what it looked to me was he is someone who was really dynamic. And I had talked to multiple people who were not huge fans of the governor, but liked Antonio Suave. And so when he was running for Congress, I thought he was a really credible candidate. Then all these things come out about how he had had, you know, these business deals go sour, and he had been giving contracts and consulting jobs to business partners, and that ultimately, although the governor wouldn't admit it at first, Governor Brownback's office eventually admitted they told him he had to leave or be fired. So that was a big revelation, and boy, on the outside, it made it look like that race, his race for the 2nd District seat, was done.
That's Stephen Caranda, KPR State House Bureau Chief, revisiting some of the year's biggest political stories in Kansas. A special thanks to Stephen, Jay Schaefer, Laura Lorson, and Greg Eklund for their help with today's program. I'm Kay McIntyre. KPR Presents is a production of Kansas Public Radio at the University of Kansas. From all of us at KPR, Happy New Year.